We are all of us familiar with Hamlet's moving soliloquy. To be or not to be, that is the question. The melancholic prince's anguish is movingly told. Whether he must suffer life's indignity, or whether it would be better for him to speed its hasty conclusion. To be or not to be, that is the question. Or is it? Most of us, fortunately, lack Hamlet's brooding depression. Life is our natural habitat. It is all that we have. Although it might be more to our cut of cloth, it is not altogether unwelcome. We find sunlight and excitement and love and fulfillment despite the gray hours and the occasional bruise. We are in no hurry to summon the angel of death to our door. To live or not to live, that is not the crucial human question, but how to live is. Life is bearable, if not an adventure, but life is also confusing. We need guidance. We need counsel. We need a road map and a set of landmarks by which to set our sights. For life is not a prefabricated object which comes to us carefully engineered and calibrated from the production line. It is uncut lumber and unlaid brick, and we are the contractors of our own destiny. Life is not made for us. We make our lives for ourselves. The ancient Chinese delighted to figure life as a seed. The seed is carefully planted, fertilized, raked, irrigated, pruned. It ripens into sound fruit. But if it is carelessly tossed out and indifferently tended, the seed withers in the ground. The sprout never matures into the harvest. It is not the seed but the farmer that ensures the harvest. We are the farmers of our own lives. Life is opportunity. Oh no, I protest. God shortchanged me. So was the complaint of the latest applicant for admission to the heavenly tribunal. I never had a chance. Some have opportunity, I had none. I was born in a drafty, dirty, one-room log cabin. My parents were semi-literate, often liquored. My father deserted my mother at an early age. I was put out then early to a man's chores, and I had little time for a schooling, for book learning, for an education. My friends were like me, ruffians and toughs. We were physical. We were not trained to use our minds. We had little chance and little interest. How could I have become other than that which I did become? The archangel did not answer. Rather, he turned to the court attendant and ordered him to summon President Lincoln to sit in judgment on this applicant. How easy it is to invent excuses for our own failings and for our own foibles. They pour out these rationalizations of ours. We blame God. We lay our complaint to the times, to our physical soundness or ill health, to the color of our skin, to our birth religion, to our social class, to the times, to our genes. It matters not. 100 excuses are ready at hand. But are these excuses justified? No one in our century could lay greater complaint against the fates, perhaps, than Prince Luthuli. If he had been born a half century ago into his home and into his house, he would have been master of half a continent, for the Bantus of which his family were sovereign ruled most of the southern part of Africa. Instead, he was born into a nation whose walls of apartheid reached to the heavens. Not only has he been stripped of his power, of his glory, of the badge and the reality of office, but he cannot even move about freely in his own country, much less vote or enjoy any civil rights. He lives in a backwater country reservation, in a wattle hut, impoverished. And yet his name will be long remembered when those of his emperor ancestors have already been forgotten. Indeed, he was awarded this year as an example of human nobility and of human brotherhood and compassion, the Nobel Peace Prize. How many have turned disadvantage to advantage, disability into strength? The jurist and the thief can be raised in a single tenement block. Illness can unbalance the emotion of one and bring out the Helen Keller in another. Life's opportunity is not equally distributed. Life can always be used to advantage if we have the will, if we have ourselves in hand. And before we chronicle our complaint to the heavens, let us be honestly sure of this, that we have not frittered away our energies, that we have not dissipated our vigor, that we have not, instead of burning the midnight oil, burnt the candle at both ends. If we have ourselves completely in hand, if we have taken the decisions that need to be taken, if we have mastered the discipline that needs to be mastered, if we have been controlled, then perhaps our excuse, our exculpation is justified. But who among us has been that strong? Why not? Why not? A contemporary philosopher was once asked, what is the rarest of all human traits? And he answered without hesitation, decisiveness. And what is the most ordinary of human traits? Self-indulgence. How true this is. It is not that we do not know what we must do. It is not that our reason confounds us, but that we lack the will to carry the plans of our mind into programs of life. We know what needs to be done, but we simply lack the courage to do it. Let me place before you echoes from the desk in my office. Echoes of a young man, tired of his daily employment, worried by the lack of happiness and challenge it presents to him, concerned with the lack of scruple of this particular business, chagrined that he must proselytize what he considers to be his standards to the marketplace, who yet tells me, I have known this, I have known of my concern for these many months, yet each morning I put on my tie, my coat, and I leave my letter of resignation locked in the desk at home. What of the young lady who 5 years ago first came into my office and chronicled a marriage which was a tragic mistake, emotionally, and physically, socially? Just this past month, she received her divorce decree, and in the intervening 5 years, she has had 3 children. We know, another tells me, that we are living beyond our means. We know that we require a less high voltage neighborhood. Our bank book tells us that this is so. The increasing brittleness of our conversation, the tension which is beginning to permeate the atmosphere of our home tells us that this is so. And yet day follows day in endless succession, and we temporize, we equivocate. How many of us can say that we are not mirrored in these echoes, that we too have avoided making decision, that we too have indulged our love of routine, our innate conservatism, that we too have not had ourselves completely under the thumb of our will? Why not? Why can man not simply will what he knows is right to do? Because we are creatures of habit. Because we are emotionally secure in routine. Because our animal nature not only somewhat repelled by and confused by, but awkward in the unknown, the future. We prepared our astronauts, these men of great courage, for their orbital flight by simulating on Earth every possible activity, occurrence, which could affect. Science can extrapolate from the known to the unknown with a great degree of accuracy. And it needed to do so in this case. For whatever the innate courage of these men, had they not known physically what to expect, they might have been paralyzed by fear. But the human sciences lack that predictability, that reliability. We cannot push aside the mist which veils the future. Man must confront the future head on, accept it as the unknown. And to do so requires of us prodigious strength, character, will. Where will we find this strength? The cowardly lion in The Wizard of Oz expected that this Merlin, by mumbling some magic incantation, could make him a present of courage. And there are some of us who go to a variety of cultic preachers, the Norman Vincent Peales of our day, and expect that by mumbling a few incantations, we will be given courage. There is a certain potency to self-hypnosis, but it cannot take us very far. The only place you and I will find courage is within ourselves, in the depths of our own personality. Fortunately, there is courage abundant, imprisoned within our own bodies. Our tradition images man as created in the image of God. Now, what does this mean? That God is a head and arms and legs? Not at all. That we have within us something of the pulsating, dynamic power of creation. That there are reserves of strength untapped within the human resource. There are no little men, only men and women who make little use of that which is within. Oh, but you say, all well and good. It is good to have a philosophy and a psychology of human potential. But words are vague things, tissue thin. I cannot simply say to myself over and over again, I am a man, I am a man, I will be strong and be a man and be strong. True. But we ought not at the same time be crippled by philosophies and psychologies of despair. And there are many of these abroad in this world. One cannot win a battle if one is afraid to join the battle. One cannot succeed in life if one presumes at the beginning of life that he is a hollow, fragile, brittle creature who will crumble as does a vessel of clay the first time he is shattered against the earth. Let us at least know ourselves to have this strength, attempt and dare. What will give us the strength the ability to mine the reserves of will within that, within ourselves. Determination. The very same qualities which allow the miner to exploit the rich loads of mineral deep within the bosom of the earth. Blood, will, tears, physical energy, struggle, a wrestling with the elements about him. And we do not normally like to think of our existence in terms of struggle and of battle, of blood and of tears. And Purim is perhaps a good time. Purim, the masquerade season of our calendar, is perhaps the appropriate time to remind us that we mask the reality of life from ourselves. Life is not a succession of sunlit Saturday evening post covers. Life is not a neat home in a well-manicured setting in a well-policed suburb. Life is raw, naked energy. Life is powerful potential. Potential which requires great skill and great strength and great courage to be harnessed and great to use. Life is unpredictable. There is no real security in life. We can occasionally take a vacation from its labor. But if we wish a symbol of man confronting his daily living, let us think of the child. The child perched at the end of a diving board, looking down at seemingly infinite distance to the water beneath. His friends have dived. One sees the fear in his eye. I want to. I must. I can't. I'll be hurt. I'm afraid. In life, again and again, we teeter at the end of the diving board. And if we wish to plunge in and to swim, to make progress, we must screw up our courage, wrestle with that bundle of fears which is within, master these. Otherwise, we will be paralyzed and turn in tears for our mother. Life is a struggle with ourselves. The English poet, Percy Bysshe Shelley, described to a biographer friend a recurrent dream. He was a young man, standing on the border of life, burning with ambition. A thousand potential activities raced within his mind. He would be a businessman. He would be an author. He would be a painter. But every time he attempted one of these ambitions, a stranger appeared to frustrate him. He would write a novel. A stranger would come and set a match to the paper. He would paint a picture. The stranger would hurl buckets of color at the canvas. He would open a shop. The stranger drove the customers away from the door. Finally, Shelley gave up his ambitions. A little later in his dream, a winsome lass enters, and Shelley is head over heels in love. He courts her, he asks her hand in marriage, and he is accepted. And surprisingly, during this whole romantic idyll, the stranger is absent. Marriage day, the ceremony. These two happy young people present themselves at the altar to the minister. Does anyone know cause why these two should not be joined in the bonds of holy matrimony? I do. And the voice of the stranger. And the groom, Shelley, is so angered, filled with wrath, that he rushes at the stranger and pulls the mask off from his face. Whom does he see? His own exact likeness. Each of us has within ourselves an alter ego. a familiar stranger, the man who says, "Don't smell the letter you have written. Don't offer to your employer the criticism that is on the tip of your tongue. Don't speak to your child the counsel which you know needs to be spoken. Don't make the change that you know needs to be taken." Each of us has such a stranger. And how can we cut him out from our lives? Can he be erased? Unfortunately, no. Can he be exercised by surgery? Unfortunately, there is no medicine potent against him. Occasionally, we can drown out his presence by alcohol, but that is only temporary. How can we be free of this stranger? I place before you the story of Jacob from our Bible. Jacob, you will recall, as a young man, was a scheming, conniving, difficult youth. With his mother, he managed to do his brother out of his legitimate birthright. We would not have liked our ancestor Jacob in his early teens. And having gotten the inheritance, the birthright, Jacob flees, fearing the muscle of Esau. Years pass. Experience, the hard, bitter experience of life, teaches Jacob the importance not only of virtue, but of family ties. He determines to come back, to return, to be reunited, if possible, with his brother. He sends him a message to this effect. The message is received, but there is no answer. He determines to take his family back to Canaan and to be reunited. And to placate his brother, he sends ahead a caravan with rich presents. These are received, but no answer is sent. Fear begins to gnaw at the vitals of Jacob. He divides his flock into half and sends half of all that he owns ahead to his brother. Perhaps this will pacify him. Again, the flock is received, and there is no answer. And finally, the Bible shows us Jacob on the last night before reconciliation. Only a river, the Yabbok, separates Jacob and Esau. Jacob from being reunited with his family or being beaten to a bloody pulp by his angry brother. During that night, a man comes to Jacob in his aloneness and wrestles with him throughout the night. And who is that man but the stranger, the familiar stranger within each of us, the bundle of his fears, the bundle of his guilts, the echo of his self-concern? Jacob triumphed. He crossed the ford, was reunited. We can triumph. We can triumph because within our own inner being, there is strength sufficient to whatever the challenge. You doubt this? True, I cannot draw down for you an anatomical chart and show you the specific gland which secretes courage. But I lay before you the whole skein of human history. A thousand daily evidences of human courage. I ask you only to examine your own homes and your own families. Can you not find there the living example of great courage, unexpected courage? The widow suddenly blossoming into her strength, the paralyzed suddenly burning with a new determination, those who have been beaten by life suddenly drawing new strength and attempting again? Need we be more specific? We have seen it in ourselves. We have been hurt, and we have not cried. We have been beaten, We have returned to the fray. We have loved and lost and been willing to love again. There is within each of us a reservoir of courage if we only have the will to exploit it. The Chinese have a proverb to the effect that in the long and hazardous journey between Peking and Chongqing, their two ancient capitals, a journey of many miles, which in the ancient days was done at the peril of one's life because of the brigands and the robbers who infested the road, that of all these many miles, the most difficult step of all was the first step, the step which starts it off, which sets us on our way. This is Purim. On Purim, we remind ourselves of the Book of Esther. Why so? Because there is high drama, human, universal drama in this book. Esther is queen of Persia, a vast world empire stretching from India to Ethiopia, throughout the whole known world. She is secure in her rank and her beauty and her privilege. But a certain Haman, for reasons best known to himself, determines against the Jew. And as prime minister of the king, secures his seal on a writ of genocide against all Jews. And suddenly Esther, who has thought of nothing more than of her beauty and of her coiffure and of her looks, suddenly she is faced with one of these crossroads of decision. The fate of her people is on her shoulders. Only she can crave audience. Only she can make effective petition. If she does, of course, she throws in her lot with her own people, because till this time the king is unaware of her birth or of her nation. But there is a greater danger even than this. For no one may enter the audience chamber of this emperor god unannounced, unsummoned. And Esther has not been summoned these many days. If one enters unbidden, it is at the cost of his head, unless the king in a sudden fit of generosity raises his scepter as a sign of welcome. Shall she procrastinate, hoping that the king will summon her? She has not long. Only a month before the edict of death is to be effected against the Jew. Shall she take the first step across the threshold of the throne room? If she does, she may not even have the opportunity to lay her complaint before the king. The Bible tells us that Esther wrestled with a stranger within her for 3 days and for 3 nights till she prevailed. Here a giddy, close-conscious woman grows in a 3-day period into a woman of valor, of substance, dedication. I cannot promise you that effecting your willpower can be done easily or without cost. I can promise you, as the holiday of Purim reminds you, that you have within you the capacity to pay the freight, to make the decision, whatever it need be, and to make it effective.